You are listening to the Sand and Snow Podcast, a Game of Thrones podcast where we talk about all the weekly goings-ons in the world of Westeros and beyond. Join me, Hyle Snow, and Jade Sand as we recap and review every episode of the hit HBO series, all while comparing it to George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, as well as other fantasy genre and historical stories. Now, fill up a glass of mead, cuddle up with your favorite dragon, and enjoy the show. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sand and Snow Podcast, a Game of Thrones podcast. My name is Hyle Snow. I am exclusively a fan of Game of Thrones through the television series, and back this week
is Jade Sand. That's me.
You were away on assignment. We had a wonderful fill-in last week with Amory Waters. We will have him back again someday, but great to have you back with us here representing our book readers out there.
Yes, thank you.
Lots of news has gone down, not just for Game of Thrones that we want to talk about, but for this podcast itself. Thanks to you fans out there who have been giving us excellent support and rating and reviews throughout iTunes and Stitcher. We've been selected as a new and noteworthy podcast on iTunes. Super awesome. Thank you guys very much. Just want to continue asking and begging for you guys, though. If you have not yet, please go ahead and give us a rating and a review, because we just want to climb those charts even further before this Game of Thrones season ends up out there. And then we can start next season super high out there. Yeah. There's a lot of Game of Thrones podcasts coming out there, which is good. Good to have variety and good to have competition. So, other news we had out there. Gwendolyn Christie,
yes.
I believe her name is, the female actress who plays Brienne
of Tarth.
Yes. Has been casted in a role for the new upcoming Star Wars movies. We don't know what the role is. We don't know if it's a big role, a small role, or if it's going to be through all three movies or just one movie or what it is. But we do know that she was selected. And someone else, who was the other person?
Lupita Nyong'o. She was on 12 Years a Slave.
I'm glad you could pronounce that.
There's actually a video that she made. I guess it's on Twitter. About her, like, teaching people how to pronounce her name because she knew that people would have trouble.
Well, as I said, we have no idea what they're going to do. We can only speculate. As a fan of Star Wars, we know they always have, I know anyway, they have all different types of colorful characters.
Yeah.
So a woman of her size can definitely play someone that's going to stick out on there. I don't know much about the franchise's story. I know some people are speculating about what's going to happen and what characters are there. I have no idea.
I'm not much of a geek. I'm more of like a bookie and a scientist, you know, so I'm more of the nerd type, I guess you would say. So I'm not really into Star Wars, but I am excited to see what role she'll be in.
It's great to see these Game of Thrones actors and actresses grow and go on to bigger things as well.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. I mean, that's a big thing for her to be in Star Wars now. That's huge. And so I guess we'll have more to say when we see what her role is in the movie.
Well, let's progress into our episode review. This is going to be for season 4, episode 8, titled The Mountain and the Viper. We've been waiting for this one for a long time.
Yeah.
Before we progress too far into it, though, just want to remind everyone out there that we are going to be reviewing everything in Game of Thrones up to that current episode, as well as anything in the books up to this point in the story. So, if you have not yet watched everything in Game of Thrones, or if you haven't read the books yet and you plan to, may not be the best podcast for you. But if you don't care, or if you have done those things, stay tuned. But beware, this podcast is dark
and full of spoilers.
Yes.
Spoilers.
So, The Mountain and the Viper, the moment that we saw the titles for this episode, you probably got extra excited because you knew it was coming.
Yeah,
but
I
didn't. I was still intrigued because just seeing those two names next to each other.
Yeah. I remember that you were speculating about who would champion Tyrion and who would champion Cersei, and you were like, oh, maybe it'll be this person, but, you know, the title of that episode is The Mountain and the Viper,
it
and I was trying to dissuade you from assuming that, because I didn't want to spoil it, but I knew that that
was. Well, in a way, if you make a title like that, it does kind of spoil it for you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But, I mean, how can you not? Those are their nicknames, and they have those nicknames for a reason, so.
Well, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. We had a week off last week, which was infuriating for a lot of people.
I mean, I know. Memorial Day. Where are my episodes?
Like, yeah, who's not watching TV on Memorial Day weekend, yeah. right? Like, what a ridiculous concept. But luckily, it was only 1 week. Originally, I thought it was going to be 2 weeks. And I was like, oh, how are we going to survive? Like, by the time it came back, it feels foreign to be back into Game of Thrones again.
I know. It is. Yeah, I know. It was too long.
Let's dig in right to the beginning, as we always do, with our iconic intro. We have King's Landing and a new city again, our second new city in the fourth season, Moat Cailin. We've heard it mentioned a number of times. Just refresh us, what exactly is Moat Cailin and why is it an important city?
It's just basically a stronghold, and it's the key. They call it the key to the north. I mean, if in the position that the Boltons are in right now, just prior to this episode, in order to get up north, you really have to get through Moat Cailin.
The bit it had in the intro, I gotta say, is one of the laziest ones I've ever seen for a city. It's just two things spinning. So I'm assuming Moat Cailin is not gonna be one that's gonna be used a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. But still, cool to see something new in there. We also got Winterfell, The Wall, Braavos still in there, and Meereen.
Yes.
The intro, I gotta say, is looking significantly different than when we first started the season, which I'm happy to see. I like to see that evolve, because the beginning we had, I believe it was Dragonstone and Dreadfort, which are no longer in there. It feels like the story has progressed more when you see that difference in the intro, and I don't know if that's just me.
I guess that those kinds of things kind of go over my head a little bit. Okay. I didn't really notice that much. The intro, usually I'm just like pumped about the music that's playing and I'm like, yeah, Game of Thrones is coming on. I guess I don't really, I don't get into it as much.
Okay.
But anywho.
I guess just as someone who works a lot with computers, yeah, I'm studying every little detail of what it takes to make these 3D models and get the timing with the music and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I really do love the intro. Ever since I started watching the show, that's one of the things, that was just like a cherry on top of everything that made it, you know, really cool that they came up with the idea of making it look like pieces coming together and moving and turning and showing the map so that you get an idea of what things look like and all of that. I thought that was clever.
When I compare it to another show that we've compared to a few times here with Rome and its intro, its intro is like, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as much.
No, I love Rome's intro. They have all the little drawings coming alive, and it shows you that, you know, Rome is not just about the people who ruled that we hear about all the time. It's also about all the, you know, the plebs that were there, too. And I think that the intro is pretty cool. But I will say that Game of Thrones intro is, like, something to be reckoned with.
I guess maybe when you see the other one first.
Yeah,
it's hard to go back.
Yeah, I have nostalgia with the intro of Rome.
Well, getting into Game of Thrones, we start off in Molestown. We see that disgusting mole-covered faced whore that Richie was giving Gilly a problem a few episodes ago, burping songs for a bunch of men. And what do you know? It's the two songs that we know from here.
Yes.
It's either the Reigns of Castamere or the Bear and the Maiden Fair.
Yeah.
Really need to write some more songs.
There are plenty.
Are there?
They're like little, of course, they don't all have that same kind of fame. Mm-hmm. There are like bits and pieces of things mentioned. Most of them are like nameless songs. But
I think
yeah.
the only other song we've heard was that one that Bard sang about Robert Baratheon. Yeah. That's the only other song I remember
hearing
about this.
Yeah, in the books, there are like, oh, there's a song about so-and-so. And oh, they'll be writing songs about him when he dies. And, you know,
they'll say that.
Yeah, no, but I mean, it's a little more in-depth. Like, they mention songs here and there that have particular histories, I guess, in the books. It's a little more relevant.
Well, after that trip back to junior high, the whore then goes and continues pestering Gilly some more about how her crying baby keeps her up at night, which, listen, I can't stand crying babies as much as the next guy, but lay off, you know?
Yeah.
This is just a reminder, the way I'm seeing it, that she is a terrible person, and when this happens in the Game of Thrones universe, usually that means that something imminent for them is coming up.
Yeah.
And I would certainly be right when I got that feeling. We get the sound of an owl, which, to the outsider, I guess, means nothing, but to Gilly, who's there, who is a wildling, knows what that owl sound means. It means an incoming attack by the wildlings. Now, before we get into this, I have to settle something that every time I take my notes, I'm always confused about. Is it wildling or wildding?
Wildling.
It is wildling.
Wildling, yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, now we got that out of the way. Okay. Wildings attacks Molestown. Great scene, I think. Lots of fire all over the place, stabbing people left and right. Great, intense start to this episode. Ygritte ends up getting a lot of focus as they're going through there. She's attacking everybody through the little hut. She kills that one disgusting mole-covered whore.
Yes.
The burper.
Yes.
Didn't get to learn her name. Wasn't important. No big deal.
Yeah.
Before she leaves, though, she hears the baby crying and goes over and takes a look at it. She decides to show mercy, just tells the baby to be quiet, and lets them live. Which,
yeah,
I guess is supposed to redeem Ygritte, even though she spent the last 3-4 episodes just slaughtering innocent men, women, and children. Because she let this baby live, she's okay now, right?
Yeah, I don't know. She may know that Gilly is a wildling also. I'm not sure if she does. But I think she does have compassion. I mean, they didn't show the gang killing any kids. I think maybe.
Well, I don't think they can.
Yeah, I know. I know. But, no. Remember when they showed, Robert Baratheon's bastard infant being killed?
Well, it was off screen, but they did yes.
But they did do that. That was terrible.
Well, shit, they don't even wait for the baby to be born to kill them if you go to the Red Wedding.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wait, there was that, too. There was an unborn child.
What is the name for killing a fetus? Is it feticide?
Since
we're debating all these murder terms.
I mean, she isn't... This situation doesn't even happen in the books because Gilly is not in Molestown. She's actually...
with Sam's family?
No, actually, not even yet. She's on the, like, well, it's hard to say at this point. I won't say exactly where she is, but that's not where she is right now. She's kind of hanging out. But Sam does have a plan at some point to send her to his family. So I won't say exactly where she is right now at this point in time. There is a plan for her to, like, get away from the wall because they know that she's not safe. But it's not in Molestown, so they don't have this this connection with the wildlings.
But the wildlings are probably following the same basic plan.
Oh, yeah, they are.
Attacking each little city and trying to draw the Night's Watch out.
Exactly, and they're moving up north towards the wall, obviously. That's still there. It's just that this encounter with Gilly, I'm not sure what they're doing with Gilly right now, but this is not where she is in the books. I'm not sure where they're putting her, but anyway. It's, you know, that would happen in, like, an alternate universe, basically.
We cut over to the wall where we see Sam looking absolutely distraught, blaming himself for Gilly being caught in Molestown while all this is going down. He assumes her dead, but all the other brothers with him are supporting him and trying to convince him that, hey, maybe she can be alive. She survives Craster. She survived the walk to the wall.
Yeah.
She's even survived a bloody White Walker, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. It's true, yeah. And you already know that she's alive because you saw Ygritte spare her, so Sam is worrying for nothing. Poor little Sam. He's crying and everything.
He's worried, but should he be worried for another reason?
What other reason would that be? That the wildlings are coming?
Well, one thing we were worried about before was Jon Snow was really worried about the mutineers at Craster's Keep being caught by the wildlings and extracting information from them.
Yes.
What if they do find Gilly here and they're able to extract beneficial information to them from her?
That's right. I'm not sure if she knows anything because she's been with Sam and Sam doesn't even really
She would know how well
manned
it is, though.
She would, yes, that's true.
Which is one of the things they're worried about. They're worried about them knowing just how undermanned Castle Black is and how easy it really would be to take over.
It's true, yeah. I don't... You know what? I kind of am getting the feeling that Ygritte is not going to reveal that she's even there. You know? And I think that she just has it in her heart that she's not... She's going to let it be a fair fight. That's the way that I see it, if I were to predict what's going to happen with Gilly. And I don't think that they would expect her to either, because I do get the feeling that they know that she's a wildling. And I do get the feeling that they wouldn't...
Wouldn't that mean they would want her with them, then?
Yes, but they wouldn't expect her to betray the people that helped her still, even though it would give them an advantage. I don't see it happening. And honestly, I don't even see Ygritte revealing the fact that she's there, because I think she realizes that she wants Gilly to be safe. basically.
She doesn't want harm to come to a baby at the very least. I think that was the deciding factor for her.
I mean, if anything...
But could she know about that baby, though? I mean, we say that these babies sometimes have this mystical aura to them. Is it possible that maybe wildlings are sensitive to that and she could detect that baby had something special to it?
Maybe. I don't know. And but at the very least, I think that if they do wind up knowing that she's there, they'll probably take her in as one of their own and treat her well. That's all. I think that she's good the way that she is. I don't think that she's going to have to give up their position on the wall.
Jon Snow ends us with the line, if they hit Molestown, we're next. And sure enough, that looks like that's what our next episode's going to be. Yeah. If you look at our next week preview, it's absolutely nothing but Night's Watch footage.
And isn't it also called The Watchers on the Wall, I believe?
Yeah, I believe it is, yeah. Right? We are the Watchers of the Wall or something along those lines.
Yeah. I'm excited to see that. And it is episode 9.
Mm-hmm. We head across the river to Meereen. We see Grey Worm peeping on Mysandei while she's taking a bath. Peeping Tom scene going, not Peeping Tom. Yeah, Peeping Tom. Is that the term I want to use?
Yeah, Peeping Tom.
Is that the same thing as an Uncle Tom, right?
I have an Uncle Tom, actually. He's definitely not a Peeping Tom, though. Well, I mean, as far as I know, I guess. You wouldn't know, but anyway.
Another story for another podcast, I guess. Awkward scene, of course, because Grey Worm is a eunuch, or at least as far as we know. But this would be debated on the next scene with Mysandei and Daenerys, where they're discussing what Grey Worm's intentions may have been during this stare, including debating about what parts of him may have been cut off whenever he was cut.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this, not actually about him, but about Theon, where depending on how they cut him, how it would have affected him differently, where if they had left the testicles attached, or the stones, as Daenerys would say, it can drive a man mad because he's still going to have those desires, but he has no way to carry it out, as opposed to if they remove it, then that desire is removed.
Okay, the impression that I get, I'm pretty certain I've read this, correct me if I'm wrong, any book readers out there, I'm pretty sure that I've read that everything is removed, and I'm pretty sure that they've said that in the show also. I think that it's more that he has a deep romantic feeling towards her. And it's almost like he's admiring her beauty and, you know, he feels a connection with her. And it's not necessarily the desire that you would feel, you know, if you did have the stones still. So.
Well, now here's my theory on that. What if traditionally both of them are removed, but maybe for some reason Grey Worm... it wasn't. Maybe the person just got lazy or whatever it may be. And maybe that's why he is having these different types of reactions. Maybe that's also why he's a little bit more testosterone driven, why he was the one chosen to be the leader of the Unsullied, because he still has balls.
Yeah, literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I did think about that too. I did think, well, maybe they didn't completely remove everything. Maybe he still does have one ball. But, the one thing that I was worried about is that at some point, Mysandei said that she has a brother. I believe she said she had a brother that was made into an Unsullied.
I think when they were having their English lesson, she did mention something like
and
that.
And I almost got the vibe that she was trying to, at the time, I got the vibe that she was trying to say, like, because she was saying, oh, do you remember who you were? Don't you remember anything?
Oh.
I thought that she was trying to say, like, you know, you're my brother. Like, can't you remember? Whatever. I don't know. I don't know anything about this. But
I remember thinking the same thing when she first said that, too. And I just kind of forgotten about it. But now that you're bringing it back, all these puzzle pieces are coming together a lot more for that.
Yeah, I really did get the strong hint that that's what she is trying to get him to remember. But now she has said, you know, I'm glad that you saw me. So, you know, I'm pretty certain that means that's not
her brother. At the very least, she's let that go. But that doesn't mean that still might not come around later on.
That's true. I mean, I have no idea. This is not, at least as far as I've read it, this has not happened. You know, this is not like something that's going on with them. So I have nothing to say about it.
Well, something has to happen because right now I feel like this love story is too lovey-dovey, too perfect,
it's big.
Too storybooky. Yeah. Something has to go wrong. And at the least, maybe something like that will be revealed, where they actually are brother and sister, or at the worst, I feel like one of them, if not both of them, are going to die real soon. We'll talk about this a little bit more later on, but Daenerys is on a major downfall right now.
Yeah.
So it would be completely like it to lose another one or both of these big advisors to her in this situation. I can see maybe like them going into a fight and where Missandei could be caught into some kind of trouble and Grey Worm goes to save her and maybe sacrifices himself, or maybe they still both end up dying in the situation. I don't know. That could go in lots of ways.
Yeah.
Bottom line is, I feel like this is going too well. That's all I'm going to say.
That's true.
We head north to the aforementioned Moat Cailin. Outside of it, Ramsay is reminding Fionn that he is and always will be Reek. And this reminds me of something I wanted to also ask.
Yes.
When we're talking about a character of Fionn/Reek, how should we be referring to him as? Should we be referring to him as Theon as we have always known him, or as his name as he actually is now, Reek?
I always think of him as Theon. Even reading the books, he calls himself Reek. The name of the chapter is called Reek. Every chapter is named after the person who has the perspective.
Okay. That's more what I'm thinking about. So maybe we should be thinking of him as
But also, sometimes chapters are named things that are ambiguous and you find out who it's about. So I can't say that that's supposed to be what we think of him as. I think of him as Theon. I'm never going to think of him as Reek. He thinks of himself as Reek because he has been tortured into thinking so. But he's still Theon to me.
Well, he rides into Moat Cailin and presents the terms for the Ironborn to abandon it. The commander spits blood into Theon's face in rejection, but one of his own men slams an axe into the back of his head and says, "We'll gladly accept it if it means we live." Of course, quick cut to that man flayed.
Being flayed.
Almost completely comical, to where like this is supposed to be something really disgusting and gross, but just the way it did that quick cut. It was almost like Looney Tunes.
Yeah, but it was brutal. I mean, seeing that guy's chest opened and...
the flies and the...
And it looked just like the sigil of House Bolton. It was really brutal, and it showed you finally, like, this is why this is the sigil of the Boltons.
Bruce says this is the tradition, and it's important to remember your traditions.
Yeah.
The lesson he's imparting on Reek, Theon, whatever you want to call him.
I want to point out that the guy spit blood all over Theon. It's referred to when someone has this kind of disease. I'm not sure if it's always referred to as this, but there's talk about a disease in the book where people start throwing up blood. It's called a bloody flux. That's what this reminds me of.
Oh, I assumed he just had internal bleeding from battle.
You can tell that people are sick also. In that scene, you see people sitting around and they're kind of like run down. I didn't see any injury on him, actually. I assumed that he was sick. So I'm not sure if they're trying to imply that everybody there is sick or, you know, whatever.
Some of those things are harder to get across in the show.
Yeah. They may have been.
Well, Theon definitely also starts looking like he's getting ready to throw up too when he starts getting a little overwhelmed with the situation and he starts doing that thing. He looks like he's gonna vomit.
Well, he's trying to pretend that he's Theon, but he's starting to break because, I mean, he sees all these terrible things. He's getting a bit jarred, and it's getting harder and harder for him to pretend that he's Reek. And at some point, even he has to say it to himself. He's like, "I'm Reek, I'm Reek, 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 Reek." And they're like, "What are you muttering? What the fuck?" So.
A little bit later, we find Roose and Ramsay together on top of a hill. Roose awards Ramsay the family name, making him an official son of the Bolton family. And this all goes back to the whole relationships of bastards into the families. How when you're a bastard of a noble family, you're not actually entitled to anything from it or anything like that. But I don't know if we've ever talked about this before. I don't know if it's just the father of the family or if maybe even like even a noble royal person can grant them this ability, but they can actually grant them to be out of being a bastard and be an actual nobleman.
It has to be granted by the king, and this has actually been granted by the Lannisters. You see like this scroll that Roose Bolton hands to Ramsay, now Ramsay Bolton, and you don't know this yet, but it's not like a huge deal. You're going to, you know, figure it out. It has to be passed down by the royal crown, basically. And the Lannisters have approved this. It's probably Tywin. I mean, and I'm like certain that it was Tywin who granted this right to Ramsay Bolton. You can't just say, like, oh, my bastard son is now my real son. You just can't do that. I mean, Ned Stark being the noble guy that he was.
You could treat them like a real son.
Yes, but you're not allowed to say, you know, that you have to, it has to be a legitimate marriage and blah, blah, blah. It's taken seriously.
Because if I'm recall correctly, Jon Snow is actually the eldest child of that family.
He is by a little bit. He is the eldest. So, and being the kind of stand-up guy that Ned Stark is, he would have given Jon Snow his name, I'm sure, even though, you know, it's not Catelyn's. He didn't, because he's not allowed to. You need the word from the king, basically.
During this conversation, we get a quick little nod off to Locke and what they sent him off to do, and they pretty much said, no big deal. Didn't care. So that whole thing was just a waste of time.
Yeah, I know. It was just a way to kind of connect the plot.
Just kind of way, characters. Just to fill things in the
place. Yeah.
Two things that I wanted to, that I got out of the scene that left me with questions. One of the things is they said, we're going to our new home, which I can only assume based on the fact that they're taking all this control of the North means that they're heading to Winterfell.
Yeah, they are.
Okay, that's cool to see. Finally seeing Winterfell again. And let's not forget that they aren't the only ones who got their eyes set and getting to Winterfell, because Littlefinger and Sansa Stark, you can bet they're going to be wanting to get there real soon.
They may be. They may be. This is true. I'm not going to, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm not going to spoil anything, but okay. These people all have their sights set on the North. Yes, it's true.
Well, that brings me to my question with Roose Bolton. What exactly is his intentions? Now, if he got this from this scroll from the royal family, he must still have some type of connections for them. That hasn't ended.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, he participated with the whole Red Wedding and all that. But we haven't really heard anything else beyond that. And if you weren't really, like, thinking that deep into it, you almost think that the Boltons are starting to go into things for themselves with this. So, what is it? Are the Boltons looking to just have the Norse themselves? Are they still looking to remain as part of the union with the Seven Kingdoms?
I'm not gonna say exactly what they're trying to do, but definitely they are the minions of the Lannisters right now. You know that they're power hungry, and the one place that they feel they have rights to is the North, which means Winterfell. As far as how they're going to try to achieve that, I'm not going to say. But yeah, definitely they're trying to go after the North. Other than that, I'll keep my mouth shut and okay. I'll let you see.
We head over to the Eyrie, where we have Littlefinger on trial in front of the elders of the city. Not really described too much exactly who they are. They're trying to get to the bottom of the situation of what happened to Lysa Tully, or Lysa Arryn, whatever we should be referring to her. Well, I'm going to say Tully, because I get this one line from the one older lady there who says, she was an odd fish.
Yes.
And she refers to her as an odd fish, which kind of struck me as weird. And I've kind of noticed this as a running thing throughout the show, that the Tullys, outside of their own area, don't really seem to be taken too seriously. And is that supposed to be the case? Is this just like a flub on the show, or maybe just something I'm misinterpreting? But it seems like the Tullys are not... They're looked at as a noble family, but maybe just like not taken as seriously. I mean, they're a fish.
No, they are taken seriously, and actually these people have deep respect for the Tullys. And it's actually a term of endearment that she says, oh, she was always an odd fish. It's not like they're not taking her seriously. The one time I can say that I heard that them being disrespected because of them being Tullys is when someone mentioned Catelyn Stark being thrown into the river like a dead fish. You know, that is obviously, but those are her enemies you're talking about. These people deeply love and respect the Tullys. So she was saying that as a term of endearment. I don't think that they're not respected as much as any other house. Anyone in the North would have love for the Tullys, basically. I mean, Jon Arryn married Lysa Tully, and, you know, Ned Stark married Catelyn Tully. You know, like, those are two big names. Those are, like, two big people in this case, and they married Tully. So they're definitely worthy of everyone's respect.
Okay, just making sure. Because it was just that line stuck out to me for some reason.
Yeah.
They asked to speak to another witness who ends up being Sansa, who comes in saying that she needs to tell him the truth. Breaks out the truth, saying that she isn't whatever the name that they had given her as the cover-up. Says that she's Elaine. Saying that she is actually Sansa Stark. that Peter Baelish had created all these lies in order to protect her. And she goes through this whole story. And what we're basically meant to be taken out of this is that Sansa Stark is coming into her own. She has been paying attention all these years, and she's really starting to learn how to play the game of controlling people to get what she wants and what's best for her, as opposed to just letting people take advantage of her as she has for the last number of years.
This is true. She is starting to wisen up, and in particular, she's starting to wisen up to Peter Baelish's tactics. And at this point in the book, she even is starting to guess why Peter Baelish is doing what he's doing. Really subtle things that you would never even guess. And when she guesses correctly, Peter Baelish is like, yes, good. And, you know, he is like teaching her his ways, basically. The way that this happens is really different in the book, so I don't want to say too much about it. It just doesn't occur this way. But well, you can tell.
I remember there's that one character who was supposed to be there, that bard. So how does that play out differently in this trial scene? Well, it's not really a
trial.
You
mean the singer?
The singer.
Yes. The singer. He's supposed to be there so that Peter Baelish can blame the murder on him. And so the whole thing is different. The whole dynamic is different. But I can't say anything about how it plays out, because this is supposed to have this part where Sansa is talking to everybody is supposed to have played out a little bit later after a couple other events have happened. And I'll just leave it for now. But what you can get out of this is that she definitely is starting to wisen up. Peter Baelish is teaching her to hold her own and take care of herself and protect herself.
After that, we see a scene where Baelish is walking with the elders, making a case that it's time for Robin, perhaps, to grow up and leave the nest.
Yeah.
Bird pun. But they're saying that perhaps maybe they should even choose him as a new person to back for the throne, which I do not understand at all.
Yeah.
What would be his entitlement to that?
There wouldn't be any. I'm not even sure why they're getting into that.
Why would Baelish want to push that? Because I thought he wants to try to get power for himself. So why is he trying to get people to rally behind Robin?
I think he's trying to distract them, really.
Mm.
I think he's really trying to... He's trying to show his huge support. He doesn't really give that much of a shit about Robin Arryn.
No. You know,
yeah, obviously. He cares about keeping himself safe so that he can keep Sansa safe. That's what this is about. And he's saying this about Robin because he knows...
He's a troublesome little child.
Yeah, he knows that he'll be seen as super loyal if he's like, yeah, Robin should be up there, blah, blah, blah. Because to them, that is the only person who's worthy of being on the throne right now. Because everyone else in the North now, I mean, you've got Roose Bolton, and he and the Freys have completely betrayed the Starks, and then you've got the Lannisters, and so obviously they would be vying for Robin Arryn, if anyone. So Peter Baelish is like, if I say this, then they will be even more loyal to me and believe me even more. It's just like a tactic for him. I don't think he really means it at all. And Robin, on the show he's Robin, and in the book he's Robert. He's a sickly boy. And he has seizures. He's got a lot of problems. He's like small and weak, and he just would not be at all a good candidate for trying to vie for the throne. And he's really young. He's a little boy. It's just a statement he's using as a tactic. Well,
something else I was wondering, maybe if he's just trying to put him out there and hope that maybe once he actually gets outside of the Eyrie, maybe he won't survive that, and it's a way just to get him out of the picture.
That could be something else that he's trying to do.
Littlefinger then proceeds to meet Sansa in her chambers. The only thing we get out of this is that Sansa is onto Baelish. She realizes that he won't hurt her and that they could work together and probably accomplish some pretty awesome things.
Yes.
Littlefinger then goes to have a chat with Robin about taking control of his life, sending him out there. He can't just live his life inside the Vale as he has for all these years.
Yes.
As his mother has always tried to protect him, always babied him.
Yeah, and he says in particular, this is a little shout out to my book readers out there. He says You know, men die every day at their dinner tables, in their beds, and on their chamber pots. just throwing that out there for you guys. A little inside joke.
Oh, boy. All the smug book readers now can have little smiles on their faces.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm being really, really smug right now.
All you HBO assholes have no idea what she's talking about.
No, it's just a little, like, it was a cool little thing that they put in there. Just like when Olenna Redwine was playing with Sansa Stark's necklace, remember? Mm-hmm. And you guys didn't catch on to it, but it was like a little thing that we all knew about. You know, it's just cool that they threw it out there. That's all. That's all I'm saying.
Well, in walks Sansa Stark with a completely new look. She's got a dark dress. She's got a darker shade of hair. And she's looking about 3 years older.
Yes.
She's looking smoking, if I must say so myself. The foxiest that she's ever looked. I've always found her, I'm a big fan of redheads.
Yeah,
but I always found Sansa kind of plain.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just because of the facials that she would... maybe just because of the facial expressions that she always had.
Yeah.
And I don't know. She always came off that way. But now she's got a little bit of character to her, and I'm liking her a lot more.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it necessarily justifies the 4.5 seasons that we had to deal with her being a meek, annoying little cunt. But it's looking up for her, I would say.
Yeah, I'm glad they finally dyed her hair, because as soon as she got to the Eyrie, she dyed her hair brown so that people wouldn't recognize her.
I think it makes more sense to do it now to match the character shift.
Yeah, and well, in the book, it makes more sense at the time. It's sort of like things happen a little differently. I'm glad to see that she's growing some balls, and, you know, I feel more secure about her. I feel like she's safer now because she has her wits about her, and she finally has confidence in her ability to manipulate and get by in this world the way that she needs to with Peter Baelish's help.
And as soon as she walks in looking all smoking, Baelish is pretty much like, okay, Robin, go ahead out the door. Have fun. See you later.
Yeah, he's so fucking pervy.
So maybe that's actually why he wants to get Robin. He just wants some alone time with Sansa.
Yeah, he's so pervy, you know. And in the book, it's even worse because he tells everyone that that's his daughter, not his niece. Not that your niece is any better, but, you know, I don't know, just a little.
Well, as mentioned in the interrogation scene, she actually is his niece now.
Yes.
Legally.
Yeah, that's true, because he did marry Lysa, so yeah.
We have one more scene with the Eyrie. This one is just outside it, though. Nice and short one with the Hound and Arya approaching the gate. They get there. They go through the same ordeal that Littlefinger and Sansa did of being stopped by the guard. He asks who they are. The Hound informs them that they're there to see Lysa to try to get the ransom for her niece.
Mm-hmm.
But the guard informs them that Lysa has been dead for 3 days.
Yeah. Which
the Hound, of course, must be raging. This is the second time that he's tried to get her to a family member to collect some money, and they're dead by the time he gets there.
Yeah.
Arya, being onto this, cracks up in
little
chipmunk laughter. It was adorable.
Yeah, she does. Because she sees the irony in it, and at this point, it's almost like she's immune to the fact that her aunt is dead, too.
Well, she's never met her.
I'm not sure if she's never met her.
Like you said, she's probably so used to family members dying now. I mean,
yeah,
after
exactly.
Both your parents die, you're not going to really care about your aunt that you've never met.
Yeah, I know. I think that she's, like, over being devastated about her family being massacred. And she sees it as this, like, ridiculous thing. And she's just like, oh, look, it's one after the other. They're all fucking dead now. So she just has to laugh. And on top of that, the Hound is now pissed that he finally gets to Lysa Tully after all this work, after being bitten on the neck by some random dude, and he's got this festering wound, and he gets there, and Lysa's not there, and he doesn't realize that Sansa Stark is there, mm-hmm. and that Peter Baelish is there, and that they would want Arya.
Well, that's the thing I was also going to wonder, like, is this message still going to be relayed inside? Are they still going to bring him inside because they would be friendly knowing that she is a Stark and that's friends of the Arryns?
You'll have to see. You will have to see.
Well, something else I was also wondering that could be a factor in this is we know that Brienne and Podrick are on their way there as well.
They
are. Are they going to cross paths? Are they all going to meet there together? We have a big happy family of Peter Baelish, Bree, and the Hound all together. Big group hug.
I think that if they do meet, you know, it would be likely that they would want to join forces. I mean, they're the only people that each other has left in the world. I mean, Peter Baelish has manipulated everyone into thinking that he's one of the Lannisters and he can do whatever he wants, basically. But they're like the only people that each other can trust, really.
Mm-hmm.
Even the Hound now. So I'll be, you know, you'll have to wait and see what happens.
I am a little worried for the Hound because he is showing signs of being hurt with that wound on his neck. And I'm getting a lot of flashbacks to Drogo
when
he had that wound and things just got worse and worse and worse.
Well, the witch also purposely, the witch made it so that he definitely would die from the wound. You know, when Khal Drogo got that little cut in his chest, he was like, oh, it's no big deal. He's gotten that all the time. I mean, you know, he's a warrior. Like, he has a scar over his eye and everything. But Daenerys insisted that it be treated, and, you know, he would have been fine if it weren't for the witch. So, you know, we'll have to see. But his wound, the Hound's wound does look really bad. I mean, this dude bit him.
This dude bit him. So you also got, like, the bacteria in your saliva to worry about going into something like that.
Yeah.
Wasn't properly treated, and it's in a place where he's wearing his armor. It's going to be rubbing against it a lot.
Yeah, I know. It's really not looking up.
I don't know. This pairing has been one of my favorites, and I was saying this last week that it feels like it's been getting a little long, which so I'm glad they kept this scene nice and short, and it still left me with a lot more questions of wondering what's going to happen next to them. Mm-hmm. So they're picking it up a little bit, I suppose, in that respect. I don't feel as tired of it. I think if they maybe leave them out the next episode, then maybe we can carry this story, keep going into the next season, which is hard to believe that this story's been going on since the middle of season 3.
Yeah.
And now here we are getting ready to go to season 5.
I know.
And they're still going.
I know. But we've had some good times. I mean, the fucking chickens.
The fucking chickens.
You know?
And every fucking chicken.
Yeah. And apparently only cunts name their swords. I don't know. It's been a good time with them. I thought it was pretty cool. You don't get that, like, nice, fun banter in the books. It's a little more business, you know. It's been fun with them. I like seeing them together.
And I feel like it's also paired with what we're going to have with Bree and Podrick, who I think they have a similar dynamic.
Yeah.
If the four of these people get together, I'm going to be so hooked. As if I'm not hooking up on this show.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be like a sitcom. I know. Yeah, I know. It's going to be its own thing. And, you know, can you imagine them all together with, like, little Robin Aaron, like sickly Robin Aaron? And yeah, I mean, it's like its own show. Yeah, I know. What would you call it?
The Hound Pound.
Wow.
I don't know. Okay. We head back over to Meereen for a different storyline that we had out there. We had Missandei and Grey Worm earlier. This one actually pertains to Barristan Selmy being handed a scroll sealed with a symbol for the Hand of the King.
Yeah.
It ends up being the same royal pardon that Jorah Mormont received previously. And I remember we debated about this, and you tried to tell me that this didn't happen. And I told you he had definitely received that scroll from some kid on the show.
No, I just wasn't sure that it was actually shown on the show. But, like, obviously it did happen. But I just had never... I don't remember it. I didn't remember it happening on the show at all.
So is that something that was revealed at all previously in the book? Or is this the first that anybody would have heard of it?
Yeah, no, it was revealed in the book. Like, you know that he was given a pardon. And you know that he knew that Daenerys was going to be poisoned if he didn't intervene. And, I haven't been looking forward to this at all.
See, because in the show, you actually didn't know that he knew that. That it was just kind of like some witchcraft that he knew.
Yeah, it's implied. Like, he knew.
Barristan Selmy goes to confront Jorah about it, I guess he doesn't slam it, he places the scroll down in front of him.
Yeah.
Says he confronts him man-to-man rather than going behind his back. Jorah is called into the throne room, where he confesses everything that he had done, confesses all the information that he released, and even confesses his love for Daenerys at this point.
Yeah.
Friend zone no more.
Yeah. I told you that. Well, he reveals his love for her earlier on in the books. He makes it much more blatantly clear. He actually kisses her at one point. And she tells him, like, you know, you're not doing that ever again. Don't. Yeah, and I told you the whole story where he was basically banished from Westeros. Or, well, he had to leave or else he was going to die. And he saw this when he met up with Viserys. He saw this as an opportunity to get a royal pardon. He was right. He started sending secrets through Varys to Robert's advisors. And so obviously it eventually reached Robert Baratheon. But his intentions were pure because, you know, once he really saw how great she is, he stopped sending this information. He gave up his royal pardon and he saved her life. All these things... I think she's just doing this in the heat of the moment, and I think that
as Danny does.
Yeah, I know, but
when funny thing is that it's always been Jorah who's the one who's tried to counsel her against making those kind of heat of the moment decisions, and
I know
she's going to continue to bite it on him.
Mm-hmm.
She excommunicates him from the city, and he just ups and leaves. He really doesn't even like fight it all that much. I think he's so heartbroken that she's mad at him like this that he can't even get himself to fight it.
Yeah, in the book. In the book, they kind of portray him as an asshole.
He's definitely kind of an asshole in the show.
I don't think so. In the book, they portray him like he's selfish and, you know, he's doing all these things for her, these nice things for her, like saving her life just because he wants to bone her, basically. You know, they make it sound like that. And at this point, when he's trying to plead his case, he is just like, oh, look, I did this and that. And, you know, you have to trust me. And he's, you know, he's kind of being a dick about it. But on the show, he just realizes she's right and there's nothing I can do about it. And he's just really heartbroken about it. And it breaks my heart because I think this is really a big, bad mistake that she's making.
It's a big loss for her.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, she just sent Dario away.
Yeah.
Now she's going to have Jorah disappearing. That's two big losses to her council that she's had by her side the last few months that have helped her significantly.
Yeah, I know. And I'm worried for her and I'm worried for Jorah, you know, what he's going to be up to. And I'm really sad to see this happen, and I was not looking forward to this scene at all. I've been dreading it, but, you know, it has to happen.
And as I was saying, this is just the continued downfall of Dany.
Yeah.
So, and we were saying earlier in the season that it seemed like things were going way too smoothly, way too easily, and now she's hitting a lot of these roadblocks.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much more can really go wrong for her, but I guess a lot of things definitely could, as I was saying before.
Yeah.
She still has a lot more people she can lose, and for that matter, she could really lose everything. You know, she can lose Meereen, she could lose her dragons, she can lose the Unsullied.
Yeah.
I definitely think that there's going to be something shaky with Dario and the Second Sons. I would not count them being on her side much longer.
It could be. I feel like at this point, Dario has kind of proved himself, but you are right that, you know, he did betray the last guys he was with just for himself, for selfish reasons.
He's going to have his Darbs of Lorak.
his Dar Solorak, yeah. And yeah, that's another thing. You haven't really gotten to see the dynamic of the city so far and what's going on with the Masters. They briefly mentioned that there were some like outbreaks of people being killed by the hands of the Masters. Obviously not the Masters, you know, it would be their slaves or whoever they get to do it. But you've heard really briefly, you might not have even mentioned it, that the Masters are, you know, kind of like seeking their revenge a little bit. You've heard about a couple of killings that have gone on at their hand. And what you also don't get, but is in the book so far, is that, you know, there are like cultural differences also. She has to wear this tokar. They still have not shown her wearing a tokar. But she wears this tokar because she's giving in to the culture of that place. And she knows that she needs to put on her floppy ears, she calls it. She needs to put on this face for everyone so that they're used to her. And she's not a foreigner to them because she wants to be their queen. She wants to be one of them. But she also has to please the Masters because she can't have any problems going on right now. And you guys aren't getting the sense of that yet, but...
Not at all.
There are, yeah, not at all, but that's brewing now.
The only thing we've really gotten for that is when she granted Hisdar Zolarak to take down the Masters from the crucifixions, which we actually saw physically in this for a brief
exactly.
second.
She doesn't want to do that, but she knows right now that she's not in a position to refuse. She really has to, if she wants to keep the peace, especially now that she's learned that at Yunkai and Astapor, things are not the way that she left them. So she's kind of trying to keep a nice balance right now, and you guys aren't really getting a sense of it on the show, but there's that going on too. And I think that she's really being pulled in a lot of directions, and her getting rid of Jorah Mormont is just like, this is not the time ever, but it's definitely not the time right now. So I'm disappointed.
But at the same time, how could she keep him around if she doesn't feel like she can trust him?
I know, but she can.
Should she just be like, what the hell's his name? Stannis?
Yeah.
And just keep her right-hand man locked in a dungeon until she feels like it's time she can take him out again?
But it's sad because we know that she can trust him, but she doesn't know. And this is like, you know, a lover being cheated on. They never know that they're going to be able to trust the other person, even though they definitely can. You know, like, you can never get over that feeling of being betrayed. And she feels like that. And she's never going to not feel that way. She's always going to feel like, well, what if now he decides to take this royal pardon and everything goes to shit? So she can never trust him, but we know that she can, because we know Jorah, and she can't ever know that.
Well, it's time for our final set of events here. We head down to the dungeons of King's Landing, where we have a little interaction with Tyrion and Jaime, possibly the last one we'll ever see between these guys. They're sharing wine and discussing the upcoming trial by combat.
I know.
They have a fun little back and forth talking about how there's all these different terms for all the people that you can kill in your family.
Yeah.
And they say that there's no term for cousin killing. And I decided to hit up the internet to find out if that is in fact true. And it is not. There is a term for cousin killing. In fact, there are two terms for cousin killing. Now, you're more of the linguist here. You know more about the other languages. I'm strictly English. This stems from Latin roots, which I guess a lot of these words actually come from, infanticide.
And Greek, but yeah.
And I think this might be true in Greek too. And I know that Japanese do this a lot too, where they'll have different terms depending on which side of the family it'll be on, whether it's the maternal or the paternal.
Yes.
So that's how this actually works. So if your cousin is on your father's side, it's patrulicide.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's on your mother's side, Sabrina side.
Yes.
I don't know if I pronounced those correctly or not.
It sounds good, yeah.
So, ha! Take that.
Yeah. That's cool.
But I guess the more important question to ask, what do you call someone who kills beetles?
I don't know. Coleoptera is the order of insect that beetles belong to. So, coleopteracide? I don't know. Coleopteracide?
I was just going to say you call him Orson Lannister. If you want to go down that route, that's cool, too.
Well, Orson Lannister is a coleopterus. Wait, how would you even... No, I don't even... Ah, man. Anyway.
Well, Tyrion's recounting the story of a simple cousin they have who used to spend all of his days just smashing rocks and killing beetles. Does that sound to me? Gung, gung.
Yeah, gung. Yeah.
Go on, do it.
No. Embarrassing me. No.
Okay. This whole thing goes on, I think, for a little bit too long, where Tyrion's questioning about why he did it and how he studied him for all that time. You know, kudos to Peter Dinklage. We've sung his praises plenty of times throughout this season. He did his best with what he could, but I feel like maybe it could have, in editing, been made a little bit shorter, or maybe the director should have told him to make it shorter, but I feel like this just dragged, and by the time it actually got around to what the point of it was, I had dozed off and I had lost interest in the conversation.
I didn't, actually. I think that it's meant to drag on because it's meant to be monotonous, and it's meant for you to forget about what it was supposed to be about in the first place, because it's a comment about the senselessness about killing, especially in their environment. I mean, he's talking about how this guy who he is mentally retarded, and he doesn't know anything outside of just killing these beetles, just smash the beetle. And he sees a little pill bug and he just picks it up, puts it away, and doesn't smash it. Like most people, if you see an insect or a bug, whatever, most people will just kill it right away. And he considers... It's meant to be this monotonous tirade of this guy who is just senselessly killing all of the time. And then he just dies. And it's like, spent all this time killing beetles, and then he just fucking dies. And there's no... And it means nothing. And that's the point. The point is that all of this senseless killing doesn't mean anything. So why do it in the first place? And that's what Tyrion's message is supposed to be about, I think.
Anyway. No, you're right, because even from the very beginning, he was questioning why there was so much killing. Yeah. Talk about how they're going into this trial, which was based on a killing of King Joffrey.
That he didn't even
and
do.
They're
going
to settle it by two other guys killing each other to determine whether he should be killed.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's just all this killing everywhere.
I know, and he even says that he spent hours and days trying to figure out why this kid was doing this, and he spent all his time obsessing over it. And the reason is because it's just, like, so baffling why everyone is so obsessed with killing, and we don't know. It's just ridiculous. So that's what I got out of it.
We hear the bells. It's time for the trial by combat. Tyrion gets brought into the King's Landing arena, where he meets up with Oberyn before the fight and criticizes just everything about him. He nags him for his choice of armor, he nags him for drinking, he nags him for not wearing a helmet, which I guess comes into play.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess understandable because his life's on the line, but man, this guy's a skilled warrior. You think he would know what he's doing.
Yeah, Oberyn Martell chooses to fight with very little armor because it makes him light and nimble. Also, no detail is spared. His armor matches Ilaria Sand's outfit. They've got the same, like, scale thing going on. She's got these shoulder things and her back piece. That's another thing I like about this show a lot. They're really into the aesthetic detail.
I actually didn't even catch it. I noticed they were the same colors, but I noticed that actually was the same, whatever you would call it, the skin or whatever would it be made out
of. It's probably some type of leather.
Oberyn comes out of the gate, being a total show-off, throwing his spear all over the place. He starts the fight off and begins to interrogate the mountain throughout the entire fight, demanding that he confesses to the rape and murder of his sister and her children.
Mm-hmm.
He has the fight pretty much won, but he lets his pride get the best of him, allowing the mountain to overtake a moment of his distraction. And the mountain reaches his hands around his head, pushes down into his eyes, and then just explodes his head all over the place. The sound it made, poof, Ilaria Sand is screaming her brains out.
Yeah.
The mountain falls over. You see the crushed-in head of Oberyn Martell. The mountain is laying there motionless as well.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Really awful. Like, Oberyn has, like, not even been around for a season.
I know.
And now he's gone.
I loved Oberyn Martell, and in the book, too. He's a cool dude, but especially on the show. Like, in the book, it's rumored that he's bisexual, but in the show, it's like he's a beacon of... I don't know.
He's a beacon of open sexuality, if anything.
Yeah, like, he's really...
He almost takes it as part of his character, and he takes great pride in it.
Yeah, exactly, and it's really cool to see that. It's sort of like, you know, we're all rooting for him for that, too. And he's awesome on the show, and I've come to really love him, and the whole time I've been like, oh, no, he's gonna die. And the show has, like... ripped my heart apart, you know, but in the book, I just want to say, I don't know if it's just my impression or if it really is how it's described, but the impression I got in the book is the battle is dragged out a lot more. Maybe it's just because I was reading it as opposed to watching it on television, but they make it sound like it's a huge stadium and there are like tons and tons of people and it's just like this big affair and they make the mountain sound, or at least in my mind, the mountain sounds like 10 times, no, well, not 10 times, but twice as big as the Red Viper, and it's just so elaborate in my mind from reading it in the book. And on the show, it's like, it's a little disappointing to see the way that it played out on screen.
I'm
going to
be perfectly
short.
Honest with you, I think you just got your expectations up way too high.
Yeah.
And I don't know if maybe, from what I've read, actually, it's been very faithful for the translation of how they did the scene, like almost shot for shot how they would have had it in the book.
It is, yeah. Every strike with his spear is basically the same. The only part that's different is that the mountain just basically gives him one big shot to the head and it makes his brains go flying.
Well, that's his teeth.
He pretty much knocks his entire mouth of teeth out with one fist shot.
Yeah, but in this, he actually squeezes his fucking head until it explodes. It's crazy. I guess when I read it in the book, it just really got to me, and I had this big picture in my head. But yeah, every shot is really faithful to the book, yes.
Because of the death of Oberyn there, that means that Tyrion, in the eyes of the gods, is guilty. Yeah. Tywin sentences him to death. And that leads to our fade to black.
Yeah.
And that's what we're left with. First off, I want to say they went to silent credits after this, which I think was awesome. Some music did come in subtly later on, but it definitely was a good 10, 15 seconds of silence. And I love when they do that. The only other time I really recall them doing that was after the Red Wedding.
Yeah.
They cut to silent credits.
I'm glad they did, because if they had put any music, I feel like it would have been inappropriate, because these were shocking scenes. The Red Wedding, I was crying. Even though I had already read it in the books, when I read it in the books, I was crying. And then when I saw it again on screen, I was crying. If they had any music, it would have been inappropriate. And the same with this. You have Ilaria Sand screaming bloody murder about her lover having his head exploded. She has 4 kids with this guy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just like, it's a really powerful scene. And Tyrion, you are sensing impending death for him. And it's just, I'm glad that they did that.
So we're left with a lot of questions on this. One of them, we don't know if the Mountain's living through this. We don't know if he survived. He's been impaled with that spear a number of times. He had his Achilles heel torn, so even if he does survive, he's not going to be as mobile as he once was.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of unfinished business between him and the Hound, and that's actually when I was theorizing over who was going to win this fight with Amory Waters last week. I actually had a lot of evidence supporting the Mountain surviving, because he had a lot more to live for, as opposed to Oberyn, who really just had this revenge that he was trying to get. And if he dies here, well, then that's just the end of the revenge. As opposed to the Mountain, who I feel like has a little bit more complexities and reasons to still be around after this. With Oberyn down, that opens the door also for more Martells to come in. As you said, he has 4 children with Illyria alone, not to mention 4 more.
Yes.
Not to mention the whole Martell family out there. We've heard Prince Doran mentioned a couple times. I have a feeling that's someone we're going to see lurking for not just revenge for Illya, but now for Oberyn as well.
Yeah, and Trystane is promised to marry Myrcella Lannister. Well, not Lannister, Baratheon, but we all know she's a Lannister.
I make that mistake all the time, too.
I always call her Lannister, but she's not. She's a Baratheon. Yeah, there's a lot that could come into play with that.
Because I refuse to believe that this is our only experience of the Martells throughout this entire story.
No, I do think you're going to see some other Martells soon. And especially now, Oberyn is, like, really well-loved. I mean, we loved him, and we barely know him. And he's really well-loved in Dorne. And he's got his 8 daughters, and then you've got his brother, who has 3 kids. And you'll find out soon, like, they're close with each other. I think you're going to see the Martells really soon.
And with that, I hope that also means that we see Dorne.
Yeah, I was so excited to see Dorne. I really do want to see Dorne.
And we're talking about how much we've grown to love the character of Oberyn Martell on the television show. That is very much in big part due to the man who played him.
Yes.
Pedro Pascal, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Freaking awesome guy.
Yeah.
I hope for big, big things in his career. We're talking about Gwendolyn Christie getting to Star Wars. I hope this guy can find equal success.
Yeah. I did really like how he portrayed the character. I really liked what they did with his character. I hope to see him again. That was cool. I loved his character. As far as the Mountain goes, you are left up in the air. In the books, there are rumors that Oberyn Martell likes to use poison on his spears. But you don't know if it's true or not, so that's like a question at this point.
It would kind of fit, considering he is considered to be the Viper.
Yes, exactly.
That
he strikes with poison, right?
Yeah, makes total sense.
He's venomous, right? But it's left up in the air. You don't know whether or not he is. But he has gravely wounded the Mountain you've seen already anyway. Mm-hmm. So if anything, his life is still on the line, hanging in balance. And also, I think it's kind of BS that the Viper is dead, but the Mountain is like
almost surely dead right now, and they're just like, oh, he's definitely, you know, we're definitely, yeah, he's definitely the winner.
I thought that was kind of awkward, too. Yeah, it's like, unless the mountain is at least, like, stirring around and showing some signs of life, like, he just keeled over, and if I wasn't thinking that deep into it, you would just assume he's dead, too.
I know. I mean, it's like, I don't know, and I've heard other people say this, too. And if I were there, I wouldn't call that just. I wouldn't say, you know, like, oh, the mountain definitely won. So I would call for a rematch. But I guess you can't really, you know, one guy's definitely dead, so.
Well, it also creates a little bit of questioning in it, too.
Yeah,
you know, it allows does. A little bit of a chance for Tyrion to continue fighting for something, which brings me to my final question that we're left with this. Is there any hope for Tyrion after this? Specifically, is Jaime going to be able to help Tyrion at this point? Because I think that's the only person who's going to be able to find a way to help him from this point.
I think that if there's anywhere way out for Tyrion, if he can't make a case about his champion, maybe if the mountain dies, he might be able to make a case, you know, well, the mountain also died from his wounds during battle, you know, whatever. If that doesn't play out, I think the only person who would even be willing to put their ass out there for Tyrion would be Jaime. And Jaime's the only person who would be able to and not be sacrificed immediately, because he is, Tywin still does want him to be his heir. And I think that Jaime's the only person who would have the balls or want to, and the only person who really can without Cersei taking them down immediately.
They've said in interaction between the two of them before that Jaime is the golden boy. He can pretty much do absolutely anything and get away with it.
Yeah, I know. And not that he's trying to. He's not even considering the fact that he can do whatever he wants when he fights for Tyrion. He does that because he loves Tyrion, and he wants to do this, even if it means fucking himself over. He wants to help Tyrion so badly. He's the only person who wants to. I mean, he's like the only person who loves Tyrion right now. So, yeah, if that does have to come into play, I think that he'd be the only person who would want to do that for Tyrion.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to add to this episode's recap?
Nope, that's it.
Hit the big events there. As I said, our preview for next week is pretty much all Wildling and Night's Watch footage, so we have that to look forward to. Yeah. I hope we at least have something else in the episode, and that isn't just 1 hour of Jon Snow swinging a sword, as much as I like Jon Snow and him swinging a sword.
Yeah, okay, the episode with the Battle of the Blackwater,
that took place like 30 to 40 minutes of the episode. It took a lot of it.
But there was some other stuff
there. There was lots of other stuff in there,
okay. Yeah, they probably had to make a connection between the previous episode and the next episode also. So I would assume that would be happening here too. It's probably going to happen something like that.
I certainly hope it's going
to be a big thing. Yeah, it's going to be a big thing, but I think that they do have to make a little bit of a connection with what happened just before and what's going to happen soon, you know? So I can't imagine them taking the entire episode. They have to make some kind of...
Unless they have some really awesome stuff planned, which, you know, maybe they do. I don't know. But then after that, there's only one episode left. So 2 episodes total left in the season. And went by sure fast.
It went too fast.
Yeah. But it's been fun recapping it here, and we will finish out the season. Then we're going to have the off season to figure out things to talk about. You know, we're not going to completely disappear from you guys. We'll still be around, but we'll cover that hurdle when we get there.
I have lots of things that I want to talk about, actually. Lots and lots of things. All right. So.
Well, that'll be treats for the book readers, so I'm probably not going to be able to participate.
No, actually, no. I would really like to talk about the history behind George R. R. Martin's books, because they are based upon actual historical events, kind of loosely, but, you know, real events. And I've been looking into them a lot lately, and I would really like to talk about it. And then, of course, I would like to theorize maybe about what's to come. And then, of course, for those of you who are not book readers, you probably wouldn't want to listen to that. But for those of you who are, those events that they're based off of might give some insight into what might be coming for the next 2 books that have not been released yet.
So you can look forward to that when we get to those points. As I said, we're all just kind of figuring out. If you had some feedback you want to submit, head to our Facebook page. You'll hear it in the after credits portion telling you how to get to that. We enjoy any kind of feedback we get, so get into that. As I said at the beginning, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher if you have not already. That helps us climb the charts and help other Game of Thrones fans find this podcast. And until next week, I am Hyle Snow.
And I'm Jade Sand.
And this has been the Sand and Snow Podcast. Just listen to the Sand and Snow Podcast, a Game of Thrones podcast covering all the weekly goings-ons in the world of Westeros and beyond. If you've enjoyed the show, receive every episode automatically by subscribing to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio with your iOS or Android device. We are also proud to be available as part of FanboysAnonymous.com and MegapowersRadio.com. Please support all the other great content available on both of those networks. If you would like to communicate with us, please do so by liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/sandandsnowpodcast, on Twitter at sandandsnowpod, or by emailing us at sandandsnow@megapowersradio.com. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see y'all next time on the Sand and Snow Podcast.